From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with the author Claudio Lomnitz, whose new book is Nuestra America, My Family in the Vertigo of Translation, published by The Other Press. Named a most anticipated book of the year by Kirkus Reviews, Nuestra America studies the intersection between Jewish and Latin American culture by way of an immigrant family memoir. Nuestra America traces Lomnitz's grandparents' exile from Eastern Europe to South America. At the same time, the book is a pretext to explain and analyze the worldview, culture, and spirit of countries such as Peru, Colombia, and Chile from the perspective of educated Jewish immigrants imbued with the hope and determination typical of those who escaped Europe in the 1920s. Claudio Lomnitz is an anthropologist, historian, and critic who works broadly on Latin American culture and politics. He is professor of anthropology at Columbia University. Lomnitz's books include Death and the Idea of Mexico and The Return of Comrade Ricardo Flores Magón, among others. As a regular columnist in the Mexico City paper La Jornada and an award-winning dramaturgist, he is committed to bringing historical and anthropological understanding into public debate. Our interview begins with my first question for him. I hope you enjoy our conversation. So I enjoyed the story in your acknowledgments of how you came to write the book and how the original project changed to something more personal as you started working on it. So I wonder if we can start there and you could share that story with listeners.
Yes. I mean, I started writing this book not as a family memoir, which is what the book is, but prompted by an event, a very specific thing, which was that there was a very famous, very revered anthropologist and archaeologist in Colombia, considered kind of like the father of Colombian anthropology, Gerardo Reichel Dolmetov was his name. And a few years ago, he was kind of outed in a big meeting of Americanists, Society of Americanists, a French society that is a worldwide organization, was created in the 19th century. He was outed by a fellow archaeologist as having been a member of the SS very early, actually. He became a member of the Nazi Party in 1929 before the ascent of Hitler, and of the SS even also a little bit before the ascent of Hitler and until the mid-30s, and where he was let go from the SS and then migrated to Colombia in 1939. And that whole story had been completely unknown. Mm-hmm. The story caught my attention because Reichel had been very close to and sort of claimed himself to be a student of Paul Rivet, who was the founder of the Musée de l'Homme in Paris and the famous socialist. And my grandfather had also been a student of Paul Rivet in the 30s. And my grandfather had been a communist or leftward leaning and who had emigrated to Peru and then to Colombia. So all of a sudden I thought, oh, that's interesting. We have two people who were the students of the same person, of the same guy. One of them, a Jew, and my grandfather, and a leftist. The other one, an Austrian aristocrat and a Nazi. And what and both of them were actually very attracted to Native South American history. My grandfather was also an ethnologist, and although he'd never made it like Reichel did. Reichel was a very, very, very famous founder of, like I said, institutions in Colombia and the like. My grandfather kind of always made a very modest living as a teacher. So I kind of wanted to understand how a Nazi aristocrat and a Jewish communist could, on the one hand, converge around the same kind of issues and what difference their background might have made toward their approaches to America, South America.
Yeah. Right. And it just went from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then eventually I got rid of Reichel because I just wrote about my own family in the end.
Yeah.
But I did do a lot of research on that before and a little bit of writing before dropping it.
Yeah. Okay. I wonder if you can explain this sentence from the book. You write, "My mother tongue is a linguistic shipwreck." I thought that was a great sentence, and I thought it was a good way for us to talk a little bit about the history of language in your family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's something that I had to face up to in order to be able to write, because I'm mainly bilingual. My Spanish is my mother tongue, but I learned English as a boy. I also learned French as a boy, and then I kind of forgot French and I relearned it. And but my two strong languages have always been Spanish and English. And Spanish is the kind of language of the home, mostly, but although I sometimes use English in the home as well. As a result of that, I always grew up kind of insecure in both languages. I say nothing of French and Portuguese that I also speak, but I'm much more insecure in. But these two, I never felt that I actually kind of dominate or control or either language. Mm-hmm. That often was a little bit of a complex for me. I mean, I write in Spanish. I write I have a column in a paper in Mexico City. And most of my books I've written in English, although some of them I wrote in Spanish originally. And always I had some insecurity sometimes around spelling, sometimes around phrasing, sometimes around whether a word was actually a word or not. And for most of my youth, I just suffered through that. And at a certain point, I decided, well, you know, that is my language. And in this book, I tried to understand what that language or lack of language is and where it comes from.
Yeah. Oh, it's interesting because your grandfather was multilingual. He spoke many languages. Mm-hmm. Actually, I was curious to know how he learned them all, because it seems that he already knew a number of languages. I'm trying to find the question I have about this. But anyway, he already knew many languages when he got to Peru, which is where he sort of went as a young man. How did he learn all those languages?
I don't really know. That's, I mean, they, both of my grandparents on my maternal side spoke like 8 languages each.
Yeah, interesting.
And my father said also my father spoke 5-6 languages and better than I do.
Yeah. Would your grandparents' first language, would that have been Yiddish?
I think so. I think so in both cases. On my maternal side, I think their first language was Yiddish, but I think that they also came from slightly snobbish. I mean, although they both came from shtetls, I have the impression, I don't know very much about shtetls, but I think that there was a certain snobbishness, is my impression, in the shtetl. Huh. And if there was, and I have the hunch that there was, they definitely came from that snobbish side. They weren't rich, either of them, but they were, you know, sort of middle class within the structure of the shtetl. And that meant that their parents did care about them learning German as a high language, Russian as a high language. Those were the two kind of high languages. And Hebrew a little bit, because that was also sort of the high language within the Jewish population, although in a different sense, not in the daily use sense.
Sure.
And then in my grandmother's case, they did teach her French as well in the shtetl. I don't think that was the case of my grandfather. I think he learned that later.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I wonder if we can talk about... So one of the things that happens in this book is that you do this incredible job of mixing your personal history, interweaving it with, you know, world history, the countries that you talk about, and Jewish history. And you write early on in the book of the role of the so-called Jews of the King. in medieval Iberia. And I had heard this before, this story about how Jews came to be known really through history as being so focused on money. And it's really interesting, the history behind this. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about that story, the role of the Jews of the king.
Mm-hmm. That was a surprise to me when I read about it, too. They were known as our Jews, our in the royal sense, that is, we the king.
Right.
Because when you want to understand what the Jews in Iberia, this is right in, during the Middle Ages, it's wrong to think of them exclusively as being, quote, discriminated. That's a kind of a very blurry term. It doesn't really tell you what their role was. Yes, they were discriminated, but they had a kind of theological role, which was to be the eternal witnesses of having turned their back on the truth when the truth came from them. That is, Jesus was Jewish, the apostles were Jewish, and here were these Jews who had, you know, stubbornly stuck to their laws and to their texts and to their narrow-minded reading of the meaning of the revelation and actively turned their backs on the truth. So the role of the Jews was to serve as a kind of eternal witness to the happiness that they missed, right? Mm-hmm. To having turned their backs on the revelation. This is an active role, and it's a pedagogical role for the rest of society. So the rest of society gets these people to look down on because they didn't really understand the revelation, whereas they, the rest of the normal people, put it that way, did, right? So that was, I think, their deep theological role. But with regard to money specifically, that having an enclave that had that kind of function could be used in an interesting way. And one of the interesting ways, probably the main one, had to do with money, because in Christianity, usury was seen as a sin. Usury is what we today call interest, by the way. So, you know, all of us would be damned to hell, you know. If you have a pension fund, I mean, that's usury already, right? But that was usury. That meant that lending money, which is actually necessary and was already necessary for the economy, money lending. Lending money in exchange for interest was not allowed. And so the way around that problem from the point of view of the crown was, okay, we'll let the Jews lend money, because the Jews also, by the way, had restrictions on usury within their community.
Right.
The Christians also could do usury outside their community. That's important. It's just that the Christians were the dominant society. So the king could say, okay, the Jews will lend money. They'll be money lenders, so we'll hate them for that as well, right? But in the end, because I'm the king, I'll tax the Jews, right? We're not just going to let them get rich and exploit us without any consequence. So I'll tax, that is allowed. I can tax the Jews. And so I'll get the money from the usury through the back door. So there's a kind of economic function of the Jews in that society,
right,
that is at the same time kind of everyday denied.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Let's see. Let's go back to your book. How did you find the structure of Nuestra America? And you know, you mix the personal, the historical, the geographical. How did you find your structure as you worked?
I mean, part I can't say. I'm a teacher. I'm a college professor, and so I've noticed over the years, thanks to my students, that there are different kinds of writers and different ways of writing. And I would classify what I've seen as two kinds. One is the people who are very, very good at understanding what they're doing and write very detailed outlines. Mm-hmm. and actually often can't really start writing until they've figured out exactly what they're doing and how they're going and what the route is. And I've seen, I have had, you know, really wonderful PhD students who do that and are capable of doing that. And then there's the other kind of writing, a writer, which I think I'm an example of, which is we don't know what the hell we're doing. And so we start writing and somewhere along the line, you start discovering what it is that you're doing. Right. That's kind of the kind of writer that I am. And as a result, I couldn't really tell you exactly how I organized it. It took me a long, I mean, I think this is not so unusual. It took me a long time to understand really what the book was about. For example, the centrality of language in it, which you already mentioned, you know, trying to figure out where I was writing this from, mm-hmm. even in an expressive dimension, became very central to the book. And that's not something that took me a long time to discover. And it ends up, you know, being at the beginning of the book, but
all right. Well, your grandparents, let's talk about your maternal grandparents, Misha and Naomi, is that right?
Yeah, Naomi.
Naomi, right. So they were both part of something called the Youth Guard. That's the English translation. I don't remember what it was called. It was part scouting, and then it was part Zionism, like a Zionist aspect. And it was the beginning, perhaps, of their socialist ideals, which ends up playing a huge role in their lives. So in this part of the book, you talk about scouting sort of more generally as well. And I thought this was kind of a nice example of the way you interweave your family story with the larger history. And I liked the little mention of scouting and talking about the environmental focus of it, the bent towards nationalism. I wonder if you can just talk about how that affected them as they got older.
The movement has a Hebrew name, right? Hashomer Hatzair, Youth Guard, as you say. The Hashomer Hatzair was invented in Poland at more or less at the time when all these scouting movements were invented. They were invented in Germany at the beginning of 1900, I can't remember the date, 1905 or something like that, 1901. And then in England, Baden Powell invents the Boy Scouts, and somewhere in Poland, some Jewish guy invents this Hashomer Hatzair, and that's already kind of during the First World War, around that time. What's interesting about the movement, I think, shares a lot of what you see, in the German movement or in the British movement, the American movements, but there are some specifics, I think, to do with the Jews and the Eastern European Jews that make it a little bit different. The first is to do with the question of the body of the Jews, because the rise of anti-Semitism in the 19th century in Europe focused quite a lot on the Jewish body and its unsuitability for the nation. Like, for example, Jews were meant to be flat-footed, so they couldn't be recruited in the army. And because they couldn't be recruited, and they weren't worthy of fighting as soldiers, because they weren't worthy of fighting as soldiers, they weren't really citizens, or they shouldn't be citizens.
Right.
So the question of sort of the emancipation from ideas about the Jewish body had a very particular charge, especially in Eastern Europe. The fact that my grandparents were into that, both my grandmother separately, they were into that, means that there was a rebellion with regard to the, let's say, the traditional Jewish a view of it, the traditional Jewish culture, which was highly urban, right? There were ghettos or towns that were basically Jewish. And here you have a movement that's focused on the countryside rather than on the city, and on nature rather than on the city, and on transforming the body. That's one thing. The second thing that I think is interesting is that these are mixed. They weren't Girls and Boy Scouts, but there's a single organization that had both the boys and the girls together, which is, of course, a huge transgression to the Jewish practices, religious practices of separating. This is, remember, a time when, you know, if you went into a synagogue, the women and the men were seated separately. And if you went to a wedding, the men danced with the men and the women danced with the women. So here you have this organization where girls and boys are together and they're going out camping or they're going out on, you know, so there's a sexual, I think there's this, an element of sexual emancipation, even though this, the movement, it's socialism, made it also highly puritanical. So they couldn't smoke, they couldn't drink, they couldn't wear makeup, the women couldn't wear makeup, anything that smacked of bourgeois sort of vanities was also looked down upon. So it's not either a 60s love fest exactly, but there's an element of that.
Yeah, it was interesting. Were you always interested in your grandparents' lives, like as a young boy, for example?
A little bit, not as much as I became. I used to have, when I was a little, I used to have an excellent memory. That's long gone, unfortunately, no. So another reason to write is that you're losing your memory.
So. Right.
But when I was young, I had a kind of, you know, very, very, very sharp memory. And that meant that I was interested, a little bit interested in people's histories in general, and my grandparents, my maternal grandparents, a little bit more than my paternal grandparents, who became more and more important to me, as in this book, became more and more important to me, and because they became more and more important for me to understand myself. And they were harder for me to understand. But in other words, I sympathized more with my maternal grandparents.
Yes. Okay. Right. The town of Nova Sulitsa in, I guess, Romania is this place that's mentioned again and again in the book, and it comes to serve as a kind of hub in a way, as it was this place that your grandfather was from. And it was interesting to read about it. What do you know of this place as it exists today? Do you know anything about?
Hardly at all. Unfortunately, I've not been there yet. I hope to go one day. But I didn't feel that I had to go in order to write the book, interestingly, even though the book was written in Berlin. And so I might have gone. Noa Sulitsa today is in the Ukraine. First, one of the big puzzles to me, that one of the discoveries to me in writing this book, was finding out where the hell Noa Sulitsa is, because, you know, when I grew up, you know, I couldn't make head or tail of it. You know, it was in the Soviet Union then. And when my mother talked about it, sometimes she mentioned Bessarabia, or sometimes they mentioned Bukovina, because the town was actually on the border between Bessarabia and Bukovina. And so they sort of said that sometimes a little bit indistinctly, or Ukraine too, and Russia and the Austro-Hungarian Empire, all of that. And this town is kind of moving back and forth, even within my grandfather's life, the town that he came from, you know, became part of different countries.
Yeah.
So understanding that. What I've seen from people who have written about and who have gone back, for instance, Marianne Hirsch and Leo Spitzer have written about Chernivtsi, which a very good book about Chernivtsi. And Chernivtsi was kind of like the main city that Noa Sulitsa was close to, and was where my grandmother, for instance, went to the gymnasium, where it went to the mm-hmm. high school. Mm-hmm. And they went back, and they have, you know, they participated in these networks of people who go back, etc. From my own subjective point of view, Noa Sulitsa became a network of people in South America, because I didn't know the ones that are in Israel or the ones who are in the U.S., but I did know more about the South American network.
Yeah.
So they were in Caracas, or they were in Bogota, or they're in Lima.
Yeah. Now, why was South America such a focus for people from this part of the world?
That's also something that I am a little hazy on. There were policies, for instance, in the case of Peru, which is where my grandparents emigrated, and Noa Sulitza had a lot of people in Lima right after the First World War, late 19-teens and through the 20s. Peru advertised a kind of immigration policy where they would pay for the trip to Peru of a person and their family. And it was one of the classic Latin American colonization policies. Latin America through the, especially in the late 19th century and in the beginning of the 20th century, had all kinds of eugenics driven concerns about the nature of their populations and whether their populations were actually capable, the races of those societies were actually good enough to really bring progress to the countries. And in the case of Peru, they had a very big Chinese immigration in the mid-19th century, late second half of the 19th century, and which they didn't think was so great. From this point of view, and of course the huge indigenous population, which in Peru was 4/5 of the population, and so they were desperate to bring in some European population, and they were willing to, you know, if they were Jews, they were willing to look the other way. Mm-hmm. These weren't their ideal immigrants. The immigrants that they all wanted were like, you know, Scottish or Swedish or Germans or something like that. But they were willing to put up with Eastern European Jews. They would take what they could get.
Right. Well, and it was interesting that the population of Peru seemed really not to know about Jews or Judaism, and there was no anti-Semitism when your grandparents arrived. I thought that was an interesting part of the story.
To me, it was that is something that my grandfather told me. My grandfather died when I was 13, and I was very, very close to him, and I had long conversations with him shortly before his death, actually. And one of the things that he told me, which I discredited when he told me, was that in Peru, when he got there, no one knew what a Jew was, and that there was no anti-Semitism. And I kind of thought my grandfather was very gung-ho about, was an Americanist, what we call of the Americas, and very, very fan of the Americas, and had this huge library on, for example, Simón Bolívar, which I never understood why the hell anybody would be so interested in these heroes of South American independence. But so I kind of chopped when he told me that. I was 13. I was already old enough to have some some reservations. And so I thought, well, you know, that's bullshit. I thought, you know, of course they knew what he was. I mean, they're Catholics. And there was a traditional, let's say, anti-Judaic component of Spanish and Spanish-based Catholicism. So, of course, when I started working on this book, I understood what he meant. I got what he meant, and he was, of course, right.
Yeah. Now, one member of your family, Shura, was lost in a very sad story, and this story seemed incredibly representative, as I read it, of the struggles of immigration and flight. And it seems quite relevant today. Looking at immigrants trying to come to America. Do you want to just talk briefly about Shura?
Yeah, and you're right. The story, to me, is central even to my own makeup. I never met Shura. So my grandmother, my mother's mother, where they were three sisters, they were born in a city, a small city called Mohilev, Podolsk, which is on the Dniester River and on the border between Ukraine and Bessarabia. So she was born in the Russian Empire. And they lived through the Russian Revolution. And in the early 20s, when they were still in that area, the war between the Russian so-called whites and the communists, my grandfather, who had a small business, he had a soap factory, what they call the factory today.
Was this Boris?
Boris. And he had a soap factory, and what they called then a factory is today would be a little bit like a a home business a little bit with workers, but with maybe six or seven workers and a couple of furnaces that they made soap. And so he was, in other words, from a communist point of view, one of the bourgeois members of the local bourgeoisie, because he owned a business. And there was a rumor at a certain point, or an ordinance for communists in the towns to hang, in each of the towns to hang or to execute a member, one of the members of a local bourgeoisie, and one of the people who was, you know, going to execute this was a kinsman of one of the workers in my grandfather's soap mill. And he warned my grandfather that he was going to get shot, and they had to leave that very day. So they left Mohilev at night to cross the river into Romania. Bessarabia was at that point part of Romania. And in the crossing, my grandmother was the oldest of the three, and Shuda was the middle one. She was maybe around two at the time of the crossing. Bube, the little one, was months old, so a baby. And so Shuda starts crying. She gets scared, and she starts crying at the moment when they're trying to cross, smuggle them across the river, and the boat, the smugglers want to drown her so that they don't get caught by the, it's a militarized zone. Remember, this is, there's a war going on here.
Right.
So at that point, my great-grandmother gets off the boat with Shuda and stays on the Russian side where the rest of the family crosses. And the rest of the family spend about 6 or 7 years in Chernivtsi, which was a city nearby, trying to get the grandmother and Shuda out. And they fail, and eventually they run out of resources and move to Peru. So they lose both the grandmother and the granddaughter, who stay behind. And Shuda, in fact, survives. The grandmother dies, and Shuda survives with tremendous hardships. And the families were reunited. My grandmother did meet her sister, Shuda, like in the late 60s, in 1970 or so, in the Soviet Union.
Mm.
Basically, they didn't know whether she was alive or dead until they were able to regain contact in the mid-1950s. So,
yeah. Let's talk a little bit about when your family when your grandparents were in Peru. They befriended José Carlos Mariátegui, who I have to admit I had not heard of, so I looked him up, and he's a very important fellow.
Yeah.
And you write at length about him, about his influence on your grandparents, and about their participation in his sort of intellectual circle of, I would say, socialists. And I thought it was interesting, your grandmother compared him to Jesus Christ, just as somebody who changed people. And then when I looked him up, I found this. In his writings from that period, Mariátegui observed that fascism was a response to deep social crisis, that it based itself on the petty bourgeoisie of town and country, and that it relied heavily on a cult of violence. According to him, fascism was the price that a society in crisis paid for the failures of the left. That seemed so interesting to me right now. But anyway, it's interesting that your grandparents were part of his circle. And I think that he had a huge influence on them. Do you want to just talk about him for just a minute?
Yeah. First of all, I don't think that you should feel embarrassed or ashamed not to know him, because he's hardly been translated into English.
Mm.
This is one of the many interesting things about the Americas and the connection between Nuestra America, is the Ibero-America or Spanish America, and the U.S., which is that there's often, figures. I mean, I won't say that there's a lot of figures like Mariátegui, because he was really, quite unusual. But at the same time, there are figures of the stature of Mariátegui who are really not that well-known in the U.S. or not well-known outside of specialists who know the region.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were a Peruvian, you would know him. And if you were South American and on the left, you would definitely know him.
Okay.
even Mexican, not necessarily South American on the left, you would know him. You might have read him in college or something, you know. So Mariátegui was a journalist who came from the provinces in Peru to Lima. He had an illness which ended up, he died quite young. He died in his 30s. And he had an illness which ended up causing an amputation of his leg in the 20s. And in the early 1920s, he was exiled to Italy. And he was in Italy for 2 years. So he actually witnessed the rise of fascism as well as the formation of the Communist Party in Italy. Mm-hmm. And saw the European affairs, was an observer, keen observer of European affairs in the early 1920s. And he wrote about all that for a newspaper in Lima. He had a column. He became one of the great educators and one of the great sort of luminaries of the Latin American left generally, and of also of kind of modernist vanguardist culture. He created a journal called Amauta, which means teacher in Quechua, which is one of the great vanguardists, one of maybe the two or three great vanguardist journals in Latin America of the 1920s, which 1920s, as you know, is a period of tremendous cultural effervescence all over the place, and certainly in Latin America. So you have surrealism, you have the left, the communists, the socialists, you have the rise of a new indigenous consciousness, you have movements in the fine arts that are sort of against classical artistic and aesthetic values. And Amauta is one of the key spaces of that for the whole of the Spanish language, not just for Peru. Mm-hmm. They're publishing all of the main writers, some of them very young, like Neruda, and Borges, all of the important writers of Latin America are publishing there. They're tracking what's happening in the Mexican Revolution, 1920s, Diego Rivera. So it's a moment of real real excitement intellectually and politically. And my grandparents were fortunate, I think, to arrive in Lima in those years. And they became very, very close friends of Mariátegui. So they were part of his innermost circle of friends. And one of the things that this book investigates is the connection between Jewish consciousness and the Jewish Renaissance that my grandparents were touched by and part of, and the cultural transformation in Latin America in the 1920s, 30s, which is something that most people don't know anything about. And I have to admit, I didn't know anything about until I started working on this.
Yeah, I was going to say, you must have learned so much as you worked on this book. There's just so much going on in the book. We can't possibly cover it. I'm curious how you conducted your research. Somebody in your family must have been a particularly good librarian of records and mementos, but I'm wondering how you conducted your research, and also if you had any sort of pleasant or exciting surprises as far as your resources went.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I'd hate to cast dispersions on my family, but they sucked as terms of. I'm an anthropologist, but I'm also a historian. I've been a professor of history. And I've written history books, so I don't have so many kind things to say about my family's archiving.
Okay.
There's stuff there, happily. But it's quite scattered. It was a huge amount of work to put together the documentation that there is there in the book. And much of the work really is connecting clues, knowing how to read the documentation, which I do because of my profession, and connecting it to other kinds of sources that are emerging from elsewhere. And some of those sources are things that you can find in the library, in a good library. And the U.S. has the great, you know, the great accomplishment of its libraries, which is something that people take for granted in the U.S., but it's really an amazing thing what exists in the U.S. in libraries, but also in archives of various sorts. This book, it's interesting. I mean, this book depended, and it's one of the wonderful things to me about having written this book, is that I had to rely a lot on friends and family as well, but friends, a lot of friends. And not just friends, but sometimes friends who became friends, people who I didn't know, but who became friends because of their interest in collaborating for this book.
And oh, wow.
It's just quite amazing. I'll give you two examples. One from the Colombian part of it. I mean, there's no way that I could manage so many places. Writing this book was impossible. That's why I started talking about my lack of language. Because I don't speak, you know, four of the languages that I would have needed to speak to do a responsible job as a historian. I don't speak Hebrew. I don't speak Yiddish. I don't speak Russian. And I don't speak German. I have a little bit of German, but not a lot. So those are four important languages to write this book. I don't have them. And I was going to write them anyway, the book anyway, because nobody else, who else is going to write this damn book, if not me, right? So, and I wanted to write it because I wanted to write it for myself and I wanted to write it for my kids and for others, but also because there's so much I didn't understand, I needed to write it. And so there's a kind of making do with what you can that's at the heart of this book, including my language and my lack of language. But what's interesting is that friends emerge. And for instance, in the case of some of the Colombian material, my grandparents were exiled from Peru and moved to Colombia in the 1930s and lived in Colombia in the 1930s. And my mother grew up, and my uncles grew up in Colombia. And so there's this history of Colombia in the 30s and 40s and early 50s. And not just of Colombia, but rural Colombia or the provinces. There is a lot I didn't know. And so I wrote, you know, a friend, a colleague. I have Toya Uribe, a Colombian anthropologist in Bogota. And I was talking to her about the book and asked her some questions. And she said, she put me in touch with Gustavo Álvarez Gardiazabal, a well-known novelist from Tuluá, the town that my grandparents settled in, Boris and Tanya settled in. And he became interested in the story. And Gustavo, who I've not met, but we correspond and we're friends, I hope to meet him one day, went out and interviewed people for me and found, you know, the daughter of the neighbors who, you know, had been close to my great grandparents in the town, sent me photos, pictures. So there's a whole world there that opened up thanks to a friendship that existed because of an interest in collaborating in the story. And similarly, on the German side, I had the story of the assassination of my great-grandfather on my father's side benefited completely from this connection with a woman named Carolyn Strobel, who is an archivist in Mannheim, who wrote to me because she was interested in this story, and she and a colleague of hers, Brigitte Sveger, sent me, I mean, a wealth of materials on what was happening in Mannheim in the 1920s and why my great-grandfather might have been murdered by these kind of Nazis or proto-Nazis in the year 1923, you know, through 10 years before. And which is a story, by the way, that no one in my family knew except
talked about, right?
My father died without knowing the story.
Ah, right. Yeah, actually, you describe an issue for your family that you name as column syndrome. Do you want to just talk about what you meant by that? Column syndrome?
Yeah. Something that I'm a little bit resentful of because I think I've got it myself, to be honest. But one of the things that starts emerging when you work on your own family, I'm sure that this is not a peculiarity of my family, is the question of silence, forgetting, or not mentioning. Sometimes it's forgetting, sometimes it's not mentioning. But what's one of the things that started emerging very powerfully to me as I was working on this book is how they're intergenerational, how things are transmitted intergenerationally, including traumas like what you mentioned with Shura, mm-hmm. Which I think touched me deeply, despite mm-hmm. having ever met Shura, and affected my life orientation deeply. Not just touched me in the sense of generating emotion, but touched me in the sense of affected the way I've lived my life. So there's all this intergenerational communication, transgenerational communication, at the same time that there's all this transgenerational buffering, where in fact, you know, their stories are not told, are silenced, are hidden. And much of this process of hiding is, at least in the case of my family, a lot of it is, I think, a form of protection. You have a person who just doesn't want their kids to grow up knowing that whatever, that his, like my grandfather, my maternal grandfather's parents died in the Holocaust. I didn't know that. But I didn't know that, I think, in part because he didn't particularly want to talk to me about it at the ages when I knew him. So I think there was a sense of protection. Right. And for which I'm grateful. I think to me, the key mystery when I was writing the book was, how is it possible that having this family history like the one I have, which is so screwed up, right? How is it possible that my brothers and I, and my sister, who was younger than my three brothers and my little sister, had such a happy childhood? Because mm-hmm. I did. I had a really happy childhood. And mm-hmm. and I think that part of it is owed to this politics of silence, but and these columns, right? These figures who absorb, they're kind of columns, but they're also sort of shock absorbers. They take in this stuff, they move through it, and at the same time they try to protect some of the others from some of the harshness of what they've experienced. And what's mysterious to me about it, though, is how it's possible that on the one hand there's all this protection and all of that that's partly based on one person absorbing the brunt of a trauma. But on the other hand, there is nonetheless all of this intergenerational transmission. And that's harder for me. I wish I were a psychologist because I don't understand everything about how that works.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny, my husband's family is from these same areas you talk about, but they never named the town, never told anyone even where they were from. We got out, don't go back. That was it. I mean, that's why I was asking you about the research and that somebody must have been an archivist, because my grandmother was from Romania. My husband's grandmother was from Romania, grandfather from Ukraine. That's as much as we know. I mean, it's kind of amazing. But you're right. They were protecting people from the pain that they had been through, I think.
Maybe your husband's family was protecting them from understanding that they might have been my cousins.
Yeah. There you go. That's it.
They knew what they were about, you know. No, I think that it's not either, like, I'm sure that when you read this book, it sounds like I had all this lore from Nova Sulica and from all these places. I didn't.
Yeah.
In the case of Nova Sulica, it's a little bit different. It's interesting. There was lore on Nova Sulica, but not, for example, on my grandmother. Her came from Mohilev. You know, I didn't know anything about that. Yeah. Nothing, not even the name of the place.
Wow.
So it's interesting. Or similarly, on my father's side, my father's mother, turns out, I just discovered recently, right, had been born in Poland and emigrated. They emigrated due to anti-Semitic rioting and pogroms and like to Germany when she was 9. Well, I knew my grandmother quite well. She died when she was when I was like in my early 20s. Mm-hmm. And so I knew her quite well. I always thought that she had been born in Germany, though I knew that her parents had been born in Poland. So the whole Polish story which she remembered vividly because I did find some documents from her hand, the trauma of departing from Poland and arriving, and the feeling of liberation of arriving in Germany, the deep identification that she had developed with German, sort of German culture and German arts especially, which stood for, ironically, you know, a space that was not anti-Semitic compared to Poland at that time. And so all of that was not only, it just was not talked about, not mentioned, period.
Yeah. All right. I always like to ask people for one or two titles of books that they've read lately that they might recommend to listeners, if you've got any that you can offer.
Well, I hate to say this because I've been reading, and right now I'm teaching, and so I've been reading in the history of my field, which is unusual, because I've been reading back to these classics in the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century. Like, for example, I just reread James Frazer's Golden Bough. I mean, and, you know, which is such an arcane kind of thing. I'm sorry, I don't mean to recommend it like this, but. You know, one of the things that I think, and I just also reread Malinowski's Argonauts of the Western Pacific. I've been rereading these classics and Henry Louis Morgan's book on the Iroquois. I've been reading these old anthropology books, classics, and I have to say I've been bowled over by them. I mean, bowled over by them as not only by these three, by the way, Morgan, Frazer and Malinowski, not only in terms of the worlds that they discovered that you couldn't make up. I mean, in that sense, I think that the kind of writing that I involves a lot of fiction at one level, but I've never really been an author of fiction because I don't have a good enough imagination, I think. But when you read these guys, what they're writing about is something that you could not have made up, that they could not have made up. There's a discovery of a world there.
Right.
It was still a time when these writers knew that they had to write for others. They're not written for specialists, although they're also written for specialists. And so it turns out they're quite good writers. And Frazer, for instance, is a wonderful writer, but so is Malinowski, quite a wonderful writer. And I've been interested of late in writers who are involved in, have one foot firmly planted in research, but another foot firmly planted in writing. Mm-hmm. And in understanding that what we have to do, what we're involved in, is talking to one another, writing for one another. And in some way, I've been going back to some of these classics, in part because at that time they had to do that. There weren't enough specialists for them just to write for the specialist.
Right, sure.
And they were writing for a broader audience as well as for the specialist. I think to me that is like a hard knot to try to undo, where you're, on the one hand, you're discovering something that is actually new, for even from the point of view of a small group of scientists or for a small group of humanists. But at the same time, you also know that if you're incapable of saying that in a way that touches people, like say Freud was in his writing, then it's no good. And that's what I'm reading right now.
Okay, wonderful. Well, I want to mention again, the name of the book is Nuestra America, My Family in the Vertigo of Translation, by Claudio Lomnitz, published by The Other Press. And it's been a pleasure to talk to you, and thank you very much.
Not at all. Thank you. Thank you for reading, first of all, but thank you for this wonderful conversation. I'm very grateful.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM. WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Claudio Lomnitz about his new book, Nuestra America, My Family in the Vertigo of Translation, published by The Other Press. You can learn more about his work at his website, claudio-lomnitz.com. My guest's title, Nuestra America, translates in English as Our America. In the case of Professor Lomnitz's book, the words refer to his own family's experience of America. But if you were to say them aloud, what might the words "our America" conjure for you? This week's Write the Book prompt is to write about that. Consider America, the continent or the country, as you interpret the word, and whatever sense of ownership and community the word "our" might bring to your own mind. In terms of post-election fallout, particularly this year maybe, it might be a good exercise for all of us. What is our America? Who are we? Who is a member of our America from your viewpoint? What does that collective share in common, and what do you think about it or hope for it? Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. There are lots of events happening on the Bookworm's calendar this week. I don't have time to announce them all, but I will let you know that Phoenix Books, Northshire Bookstore, Fletcher Free Library, South Burlington Community Library, the Vermont Studio Center, Bear Pond Books, Kellogg Hubbard Library, Fletcher Free Library, and the Vermont Humanities Council all had events that I would have announced if I had time. You can check out all of their websites to see what's going on. Again, we're still in the midst of this pandemic. Things might be looking up, but on the other hand, there was a Super Bowl, so who knows if that will create more cases. Probably. My recommendation, my hope, is that you stay safe, that you wear a mask, that you socially distance, that you try not to meet with people unless you're outside and able to get a little bit of room around yourself. Try to find the books that have come out, even as book tours are being canceled. I hope that you're able to read and to write. Keep in mind that the archives of the show offer weekly writing prompts to help you in your work. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, SheLaughsWithoutUs.com. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. Stay well and have a great week.